Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Group Chat from Virgin Media News. Gavin is here, Zara is here. We're going to be checking in with Richard a little bit later in the episode. He is out of town on assignment, but he's covering something pretty significant, so we're going to catch up with him in just a little while. We are joined in studio, however, by Louise and Selena McDermott, who are making return visits to the Group Chat. We've never had anyone in the studio twice before, so we're delighted that you're able to come back to us. Right. You were with us literally a year ago this week at the start of the renewed inquest into the deaths of 48 people in Stardust, which of course include three of your siblings. It has been a very long year. It's been a very long week. How are you after the week that you've had?
Tired, exhausted, but relieved and happy. Relieved and happy.
Very tired.
It's hard to believe it's been less than 7 days, really, isn't it? Since the verdict came in, because God, like, I mean, you've been on the go ever since, really.
Yeah, big time.
So the jury deliberation was 11 days in the end, 11 days of deliberations. And I know I spoke to you kind of most days, Selena, in between the deliberations, and was kind of asking you, how are you getting on? And I know that you guys were patient in a sense that you wanted the jury to take the time to get to the right, you know, the right outcome and sort of dot the I's and cross the T's. But just take us back to a moment the announcement happened in the coroner's court.
It was just absolutely incredible, because the court was absolutely chock-a-block. It was packed, and it was lovely, because they had most of the parents that were left, including my mother, at the very front facing the judge. So because they were very sort of aware of, like, some of their hearing was quite bad and stuff like that, that they would be able to hear the foreman of the jury announcing their verdict, you know. And then, like, it was just like the whole room was full of mixed emotions, because, like, even it's taken us so long, even up to then we were still had our doubt. We still were like, you know, it has to be, the verdict has got to be unlawful killing. But we were set back so many times, as you know, Zara. Like, so even up until it was actually said, we all broke out crying.
Yeah.
And then we were cheering, and then, you know, it was a lot of mixed emotions, wasn't it? Yeah.
And did it really feel like it was still on a knife edge right up until that moment?
Absolutely.
We've been discussing for the last couple of weeks just how much tension you must have felt, because this is a campaign you've been waging for 40 years plus to finally be at the end of almost being at the top of the mountain and not knowing what you're going to see on the other side. Yeah. Literally right up until that moment where the foreman delivers it, you don't know.
Even to when we walked in, and some of the reporters were asking us before we walked into the pillar rooms, like, how he was feeling. We were like, we were really nervous, we were very anxious. And some of them, I could see by their reactions, they were like, no, they've got this, like, they've got it.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh no, like, because, like, you know yourselves, even on the Wednesday before the verdict, on the Thursday, and before the coroner charged the jury to deliberate,
to go and consider their verdict.
And we were so nervous, because nobody knew that Eamon Bushley was bringing us to the High Court to still try and fight for unlawful killing to be allowed to be used as one of the verdicts of the five. So, like, the public didn't know that, because it wasn't allowed to be put out into the media at that time because we were afraid of something happening. And so we were under so much worry and pressure.
I was sitting in the coroner's court that day as that legal argument was going on and forth, and so many of the families were, they were crying. I think I texted you in the WhatsApp group, actually. I texted Richard and Gav to say, gosh, this is so tense here today. Like, the families, there's just some of them are sitting there in silence, just sobbing.
Yeah.
Because it was that fear that you had gotten so close, but potentially wouldn't get quite over the line. Louise, I think it's really important, because I'm conscious that, and even including myself, I think you, Gav, as well, we weren't even born when the Stardust fire happened. And actually, and we'll get on to it in a moment, I did do a lovely interview with your mother, Mrs. McDermott, and we'll chat about that in a second. But loads of people who saw that interview and who've seen the coverage since have been, you know, really invested in this story. But they're young people who, like, you know, weren't around when all of this happened. You know, Louise, I'd love for you to just kind of maybe highlight for us those key challenges that you faced in the last 43 years, even down to, you know, when we looked at the Sunday newspaper, the 2 days after the fire, and arson was included in the headline. So from really early on, misinformation, and we talk about misinformation in the modern age, but actually disinformation and misinformation was dominating the entire narrative around the Stardust from very early on, wasn't it?
Well, that's all we ever wanted, all the families, was the truth. And lots of people didn't know exactly what happened, like what happened in the background. Like you say, the challenges we faced when arson, when they said it was arson, We knew it wasn't arson, you know, and I'm trying to prove that. Mm. And then Mary Lou McDonald said a great quote yesterday. She said, "Who spun that?
Yeah.
Who spun that tale? Who spun that?" And we were like, "Yeah, that's right. Who actually was the first person to say that this was arson?" That was horrific for us and the families. They were classing them as arsonists, like they did this to themselves.
And to be clear, there was absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
There was
no
nothing
proof.
To prove
nothing,
that. No and
proof.
That would later be proven 20-odd years later.
Yeah.
And yet it was a line that was picked up by media and sort of, you know, pretend probably in good faith at the time, you'd hope, but was spun and really had a detrimental impact in terms of your quest for truth and justice.
Yeah, and like Carol Barrett said the other day, she lost her brother. Should we had to become detectives?
Yeah.
Like we had to fight and we had to get our own solicitors, everybody to try and help us to prove that that wasn't the case. And when we did, that was amazing. And then still we thought when we got that removed, things are going to move on now. It won't take us long. And it was just horrific then. Every step of the way, something came up. They tried to block us. Like in 2022, when we had got the, Seamus Wolfe had given us the go-ahead, we were asked then to, we had to fight for legal aid. Where they made us fill in.
Delayed a couple of years.
Because they wanted every family to fill in for legal aid. And that was really insulting to us and horrific.
It's dreadful that your instinct is to immediately wonder when the next rug is going to be pulled out from
under. Exactly.
But you're so used to things not going your way that even after you've got the jury's verdict, you're still there wondering how this is all going to come asunder one way or another.
Your trust is completely broken. And
totally.
Has been from day one.
Totally.
You know, and did you think, because I want to kind of just, I know we're jumping from one point to the other, but I think kind of to go back to kind of yesterday where the state apology happened then, I was watching from the press gallery and I was looking up in the public gallery and sort of, I thought actually maybe people would be, I thought they might cry or they might be, I think people were nearly kind of all cried out. I think one person said to me, because it actually, as much as it seemed to mean an awful lot to people and it, to hear those words was hugely significant, so many people felt that it was just far too late.
Yeah. And it was almost like we had spoken about this coming over, didn't we, Louise? That we still, for me personally, and I know Louise was the same and my other sister June, we felt almost really sad, really, really, really sad. Looking down in the chambers from the public gallery, that because they weren't coming back, it wasn't bringing them back, but just that we had to go through all these years fighting and being failed repeatedly by the state, you know, and then to get the and then it was 43 years of the 48 that died, trying to vindicate their names of who they were and getting their dignity back. It was very, very sad as well, you know, even though it was a victory and it was amazing and it was brilliant. Like, we were looking at politicians in there, certain politicians in there, like, you know, and standing up speaking, and I'm like, oh my God.
Well, actually, no, rather than dance around that, let's talk about that. One of the TDs that stood up was Sean Haughey, who is a TD now for the constituency where Stardust happened.
Yeah.
His father, Charles Haughey, was also a TD for the constituency. He was the Taoiseach at the time. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to say that many of the families feel like the Fianna Fáil governments of the 80s put a lot of obstacles in your way.
Definitely.
What were you thinking when you saw Sean Haughey?
When he stood up, I nearly passed out because we were just like, you're actually going to speak. And he didn't actually say anything good or worthwhile. I would have loved him to have apologised for what his father did and didn't do for us. Mm. And he said, maybe we should have done something better or some more. And said, maybe. Like, you know, do you realise what you had done to these families? Do you have any idea? Mm. And it was kind of like, you know, we were all, the families were all like, my God, he was going, he knew he was going to sit there. So say something, apologise to us.
Yeah. Well, do you think it would have made a big difference to you if he'd have even just said something as simple as, my father's government got it wrong?
Yes.
Yeah. Like, he shouldn't have, if he had anything to say there at all, that was what he should have said. He should have apologised for his father on behalf of his father and the party. Absolutely. Otherwise, there was no point of him being there standing up. Mm-hmm.
What did you make of the speech by his successor, Simon Harris, the Taoiseach now?
I thought it was very good. I thought it was very good. I thought it was very, very sincere. I was very happy with it. Really happy with it, you know. Mm. And I think all of us, all the families, loved when he spoke about each of the 48. Mm. And he put a bit of the pen portraits of each of them in. And
it was lovely. It
was sincere. Mm. And everything he mentioned in it was what we asked for, you know, didn't we, Louise?
Yeah, like the commemorative day. We'd like a commemorative day. Yeah.
I do want to talk about your mum, because your mum is just, my God.
She's been a Twitter superstar.
Your mum is like, honestly, she's incredible. Yeah. Like, she is unbelievably dignified.
Yeah.
And still through everything, keeps her cool, doesn't she? She really does keep her cool. Mm-hmm. Louise, you were there. So we did the interview with Mrs. McDermott. Many of you listening to the podcast will have seen it. And, you know, and for some people, I'd say younger people, it kind of was their introduction into the Stardust story, your mum telling her story. Louise, she was in good form that day, wasn't she, when we sat down?
She was actually very relaxed. And because she knows you, well. She like, she trusts you, and she knew you were coming. And she was the first time, that was the first interview I'd ever seen her talk like that.
Yeah,
I couldn't get over how honest
she talked like that. Yeah. And I was kind of taken aback myself. But she spoke from the heart, and she spoke things that she'd been feeling for the past 43 years. Yeah, and wanted to say them things. Mm. And afterwards, when you left, I said, how do you feel? And she said, I felt a relief, like I could, a relief off my shoulders. I could talk about it, you know, because she was quite upset as well, and we were like listening to her, because it's a long time we've heard her talk like that.
Actually, let's pause for a minute and actually listen back to a little bit of this. This is a little bit of the interview that your mother, Bridget McDermott, did with Sarah last week.
Did you get comfort from the shared experiences that you had as mothers?
Oh yeah, I think we all did. Yeah, we all did. Yeah, yeah, they're lovely people. Like, they lost our loved ones too. When we were out canvassing years ago, down the country, Canada's looking for money to bring, to pay for solicitors and everything. And the public couldn't have been nicer to us. They were very good. They helped us immensely everywhere we went. They were. And I thank them for that.
Mrs. McDermott, you have always been so dignified in your grief, but has there ever been a time where you felt angry?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I do. I still do. And I always will, till my day comes. Oh, yeah. I can pray and ask God to spare me till it's all over. All I want is justice. I want to meet Willie and Marcella again. Tell them we got you. Yeah.
That last sentence from your mum when she said it, Louise, I was, you know.
She's always said that.
Really?
You know, she said, I wouldn't want to, because my mother has great faith. And she always said, I want to, when I meet with the three of them again, you know, just hold up my arms and say, we did it. We did what we could, and we did do it. She did do it, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The mothers are to be commended, aren't they?
Oh, I mean,
we've talked about this. The mothers, what they did for their children, they never gave up on
them. Never.
That's what we were saying. They really underestimated the fight those these mothers had in them, yeah. you know, for their children, you know. Like maybe this again, yes, they said the ma's and da's. Mm.
Of Dublin, they never underestimate a Dublin man. Yeah.
Never underestimate, you know, and we'll fight to the death for actually fight to the death for them, you know.
Yeah.
And the government and that got that so wrong, you know.
I know that the last week is still very fresh, and I don't even know whether necessarily the two of you have had time to think about this or whether you feel the same as your siblings or your mother does. Mm. Does the last 7 days bring a sense of closure for you? Because I know that there are some families who still want this finding now to be taken and for the DPP to consider their options and to look at what more can be done. For you, is the last 7 days justice?
Well, it is massively to our family. Because I can't talk on behalf of each individual family. Mm. Because we all know that we're all delighted, all the families together. But as regards to our family, it was such a big victory because there was never any agenda as regards to fighting for the truth. Never. Only getting the truth out and getting a proper coroner's report for George William Rosella. That's another thing that the public don't know, is that my ma has a death certificate for them, but she hasn't got a proper coroner's report as into how they died and where they died, when they died and so on. So because if they had given her one, they'd have to give her the inquest. Mm. So that in itself is an absolutely appalling disgrace on behalf of the state to put my mother through that and the other parents, you know. So, yeah, so as regards to closure, we never like to use the word closure because there is no closure as regards to what we went through. But what we can do is finally remember George William Rosella, the way they were, you know, and the way we would imagine them to be now, you know. And that for us is just like, and the last few days was a massive thing. And to get the apology, which they deserved from the state, they deserved it, the 48 deserved it. Yeah, so like going forward now, like, you know, is as Dara Macken said yesterday in the legal team, don't talk about it yet. Just let it. So try to hold on to what you have just achieved. Mm. Mm-hmm. So that's for us. That's what we were doing. We were trying to hold on to the moment. You know, I think I said it to you yesterday. Yeah. Sarah. I was just trying to hold on to it because it took us so long. So, like, you know, and as regards to what's going to happen from now onwards will be what we'd talk to with Darren Macken and the legal team, you know.
Can I just, because I know you talked about remembering them, and I think that's really important. And Louise, your mom was telling us on the day, it didn't make the cut in the piece because we just didn't have enough time, but just the last two things that Marcella and George did for your mom. Marcella brought her back a cream cake because she'd gone and done the shopping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had a cup of tea and a cream cake, and that was the last kind of one-to-one moment she spent with her daughter. And George brought her a packet of silver mints because she was going to the bingo that night. And that sums up the kindness that was in your brother and sister and the people that they were and how considerate they were of their mother and how much they adored her, respected
her
and loved her.
Idolized her. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just, and I love that your mum has those as the standout last moment memories and that she hangs on to those so dearly. Mm-hmm.
And she tied Willie's tie. Stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean? Like,
that she really hangs on to.
I know it's been a really trying couple of days for you. We're so pleased that you were able to come in and tell us your story. We're grateful to your employers and everyone else that let you be with us. You've been brilliant. And thanks so much for sharing your story.
Just before, sorry, you don't mind. Can I just thank that as well? The people we work for, the people we work with, and also our families and friends that have always supported us. I just want to say thanks.
And for the record, some of your friends have sent me messages saying how proud of you they are.
Oh, yeah,
didn't get a chance to tell you that. I've received messages from people that you work with saying that they support you and they're so proud of you. And I think, like your mother, you both have also carried yourselves with great dignity, and we thank you for that.
Thanks so much.
Louise, Selena, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Now, I mentioned at the start of the episode that Richard was going to be joining us from afar. He is with us on the line now. Richard, you're at the courthouse in Kilmallocken, County Limerick. You've been covering the inquest into the death of 16-year-old Aoife Johnston at UHL. First of all, just give us the background to the case that you've been covering this week.
Yeah, Gavin, this has been a very high-profile case for a number of years since it happened in December of 2022. Aoife Johnston from Shannon in County Clare was just 16 years of age when she was brought by her parents into the emergency department of UHL after going to an out-of-hours GP who wrote on a referral letter that she had suspected sepsis. Now, she endured then a 12-hour wait in the department. She didn't even have a trolley to lie on. She was basically put between two chairs, which were put into a makeshift bed by her parents and was wrapped in blankets. She went through a very, very hard time waiting in that emergency department, vomiting regularly, complaining of huge discomfort and becoming more and more less aware, really, of her situation. It was a very distressing case when this happened at the time. She died 2 days after she arrived at UHL. It did spark a huge focus on University Hospital Limerick and its emergency department. And now we've arrived at this situation 2 years down the road where the family are here for a four-day inquest into all of the circumstances surrounding Aoife's death.
And Richard, what have we been hearing about how this has been affected the Johnston family?
It's very clear, I think, as anyone can imagine, the impact it has had on the Johnston family. We were on the first day, on Monday, we had statements given by James and Carol Johnston, who are Aoife Johnston's parents. And James Johnston described in detail really what happened from when Aoife first got sick, the distress that she was in, bringing her to the emergency department, and his attempts repeatedly to get someone to help his daughter as she became more and more distressed. He told how he roared at staff nurses to help his effing daughter, in his words. He at one point roared at his nursing station, where he said 12 nurses were standing around pleading with them, begging them to save his daughter's life. He said how other patients who were on trolleys in the emergency department, they got involved, that they pleaded with staff and nurses and doctors to look after Aoife first. Such was the situation that she was in. He said that it was a horrendous situation. His wife, Carol, Aoife's mother, said that effectively they watched their daughter die. She wouldn't wish that on anyone. And that is the situation that they're in. It has been a very, very emotional time across what is now 3 days of the four-day inquest. Huge support for the Johnston family here. Their extended family have been here in numbers throughout. And there have been some very, very emotional scenes throughout as well. Incredibly difficult for the Johnston family, as has been acknowledged by all of the witnesses and by the coroner himself as well.
Richard, one of the things that's been really striking, and we're speaking to you on day three of the inquest, is some of the evidence that's been given about the situation in the emergency department in UHL on the night in question when Aoife was admitted.
Yeah, and I just want to, there's been one point. Damien Tansey is the representative for the families. He is the person who's cross-examining the witnesses, all of the medical personnel. There's 25 witnesses in total across this inquest. And he keeps on referring to the point, as has been backed up by these witnesses, that Aoife Johnston was a Category 2 patient. And under the triage system, which all Irish hospitals use, that means as a Category 2 patient, you must be seen within 10 to 15 minutes, OK? So what actually happened in Aoife Johnston's case was she was not seen for over 12 hours. You can extrapolate that as you like. That shows how long she was waiting, much to the distress of her family. And of course, with sepsis, a hugely serious condition, that is also a very serious condition, which has a 100% fatality rate, as this inquest has heard, if it is not treated with antibiotics, which are very readily available. So that has been a point which has been probed by the cross-examinations of Damien Tansey, of all these medical staff who are here. But what has come across from a number of nurses in particular and doctors, two of which I should actually point out, have since left the health service due to the events of that weekend. One doctor, Dr. Leandri Card, is a South African doctor. She left UHL and the emergency department because of the events of that weekend, which she described as instrumental in her decision to leave. Catherine Skelly was a nurse who gave a bombshell evidence on the first day of this inquest, saying that it was like a war zone in the emergency department in UHL, that it was professionally and personally she was broken by what happened at that weekend and what had happened to that girl, as she described Aoife Johnston.
Richard, it's been clear in the reporting from you all throughout the week that the death of Aoife Johnston and the events of that weekend did have an impact on many of the witnesses that spoke in court.
Yeah, and I think actually it's worth bringing you right up to date with what's happened. So we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, as we normally do on the podcast. This inquest due to conclude tomorrow, Thursday. So obviously our news bulletins will bring up to date with that. So what's happened in the past few minutes is that Fiona Steed, who has now also left University Hospital Limerick, she works now in the Department of Health in Dublin. Now, she applied for that job before Aoife Johnston died. That's important to get across as well. But there's been very emotional scenes in Kilmallock Courthouse where she has described how this has affected her. I actually want to bring up her quote just so we get it completely right. She says she has been moved by Aoife's death every day and every night since. She looks at her own daughters and realises how lucky she is to have them. She said, I will never forget Aoife or her beautiful face. Now, at that point, Megan Johnston, who is one of Aoife's sisters, got very emotional, shouted something and stormed out of the courtroom. We broke then for a few minutes before coming back as well. Now, Fiona Steed was the executive on call over the course of that weekend. So she was the focus of some very intense questioning by Damien Tansey, who was cross-examining her on behalf of the families about what exactly she did to address the situation as someone in a leadership role in the hospital at that point in time. She said that she recommended some changes that she said would remove about 30 patients from the emergency department. We heard from another doctor that's 191 patients in the emergency department in UHL over that weekend, and that one doctor was responsible effectively for all of them. She said, Fiona Steed did, that she wrongly and regrettably assumed that her advice to put trolleys up onto the wards, for example, was followed. That turned out that it did not happen, and she said that nobody came back to me to tell her that that hadn't happened. So she had no powers as well. There's been an issue around the compellability. There's a consultant on call usually in these situations for these weekends, as it is in usually in other hospitals as well. Now, the emergency department consultant on call was contacted by nursing staff. He was asked to come in. He refused to come in, and the message was conveyed to the nursing staff that the emergency consultant on call would not come in due to questions of volume, but only if it was a major emergency. Now, obviously, all of the medical staff who have since been questioned here have described this as clearly a very major medical emergency. Fiona Steed, in her evidence there, said she had no powers to compel emergency consultant on call to come in. As she said, she had a fundamental disagreement with the medical staff, the clinical staff, saying that she believes emergency consultants should be on site at UHL at all times. And concluding her own testimony, as she said to Aoife's parents again, offering her condolences, said that it wasn't hollow. She said that Aoife was beautiful and she'll never forget her. She told James and Carol Johnston that though it's of no comfort to them, what had happened had completely altered her approach to life and to her own children as well.
Richard, as you say, this is an ongoing inquest, and you've stepped out for a couple of minutes to talk to us while it's still ongoing this afternoon. It's due to last 4 days. What happens next, and what is open to the court to find in this?
Well, that is what's going to happen. We have a number of key medical witnesses still to go. It has been quite a backlog. There has been some quite intense cross-examination, as you can imagine, as well, and some disagreements about, the length of statements which have been offered. There is, of course, another parallel independent investigation into Aoife Johnston's death, which is being headed up by the retired Chief Justice, Frank Clark. So there is an intention here to get this done, to get this concluded tomorrow or Thursday when you're listening to this by the coroner, Frank McNamara, here, because as he acknowledges that, and the HSE side as well acknowledges, they don't want to put the Johnston family through any more trauma. They've been through enough, and that is something Damien Tansey, representing the family, has said as well. They want this done. This is an open wound for the Johnston family. This is an open wound which everyone around the country, he said, can see and have been witness to over the last 2 years. So there is a hope that they will hopefully be allowed to get some answers from this process.
Let's certainly hope so. That inquest then due to wrap up on Thursday afternoon. No doubt you'll be reporting on the news at 5:30 and subsequently about it. And I'm sure we're going to end up talking about it on next week's edition. Until then, Richard, thanks for joining us from Kilmallock.
Thanks so much, guys.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There has been much discussion about this return system, which, by the way, I suppose is important to say that it is still in its sort of preliminary stage where trial and error is allowed, basically.
Yeah, we're about 3 months into it now. We actually discussed it just before its rollout. We referred to them as reverse vending machines, which is kind of what they are.
Yes, they kind of are. You've had loads of messages about it.
Yeah, so I just decided that I would do an Instagram question box just to ask people what their experiences of them were, because I saw a lot of people on the internet, which... granted, is a place where people tend to go to vent grievances these days.
Yeah.
Complaining about machines always being out of order or having general difficulties with trying to get them to work. And that actually hadn't been my personal experience of it. So I wanted to ask people what they thought.
Wait, hang on a second. Before we start, so every time you go to the return machine, you just pop all your bottles into it, it all works.
I have never had any difficulties with any machine being out of order.
I feel like you must be the only person.
This was my point, because when I saw so many people online saying the machines are always out of order all the time, I was like... there must be some...
you should be doing the lotto every week.
There must be some user
error. Much luckier than most people.
They're always fine. The only issue I'd ever had was that there was one can that came out of a multi-pack that I'd bought in the middle of March, but it turns out it'd actually been sitting there on the shelves since January, so it actually wasn't return eligible. But that was the only thing at all. But I did the question box, and there was a couple of people who said that it had definitely changed their mindsets about how to handle plastic and cans. One person actually wrote back to say that they hadn't bought a single plastic bottle since its introduction, which I guess is mission accomplished.
Yeah.
One person wrote back, though, with a really interesting grievance about it. They were in Terminal 2 in Dublin Airport. They were past security, and while they were waiting, they got themselves and their partner two bottles of water. They were charged the deposit fee. They asked staff where the machine was, thinking that they could tank the water back and then get their deposit slip back. Mm-hmm. They're informed that there wasn't one, that they'd have to hang on to the bottle for the long weekend and then bring it back to Ireland and then find a machine when they got back.
Oh.
When they arrived in Spain on their holiday, the Spanish security took the empty bottle off them because they weren't allowed to bring it through the airport. which kind of just underlines that in some instances it is a little bit of a tax the way that it wasn't kind of supposed to be, you know? Yeah. But one thing what I genuinely thought was quite striking, which is that some people say, yeah, it's a bit of an inconvenience and that they already had a bit of a green bin, so what's the issue? To which I suppose the response is, and I'm wary of sounding like I'm a spokesperson for the scheme now, but not every bottle that's ever put into recycling always makes it out the other end. And depending on what else you put into your green or your blue bin, not everything that makes it in actually ends up being worthy of recycling. Mm. If you include a couple of things into your green bin that aren't supposed to be there, they end up getting landfilled.
And your green bin is contaminated.
Basically, yeah. So the idea is that it's to try and make sure that there is a slightly ring-fenced thing. Now, one thing which I did think was very telling, a lot of people said they were used to doing it and they found it inconvenient. A lot of people noticed accessibility issues. Mm. That if you are a shorter person or if you use a wheelchair, the general structure of these machines are such that you kind of expect it to be able to stand at adult height.
Yeah.
And to be able to put it through. And if that's you've got fair. Any mobility problems, they're not there. But one thing which I did think was very striking was that a lot of people said that they were all kind of okay about it, which is something you just don't hear on the internet much.
No, you don't. Well, actually, to be fair, I think that's good to hear that now. I know that when I was covering for Matt Cooper on The Last Word about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we did this item and loads of people had problems. So it's interesting to see that in 3 or 4 weeks since then, even that actually... it's shifted, that actually people are having a better shot at it. I suppose I would say...
what is your experience of using them?
Well, the other person in my house looks after that job, so which I really love that person for and appreciate it. So thank you. But the only thing I would say is that I suppose we were always really good at putting things in the green bin, and I always felt that system sort of worked for us. So it is another thing. Also, you know, because we go to the bottle bank every week as well. Well, admittedly, now we probably go every 2 weeks, but mainly because I like those yogurts that come in the glass jars. You know, so like then you end up with this accumulation of little glass jars on your countertop. So I think between the glass jars for the yogurts and sort of like the plastic water bottles, at times it can be just a bit of a build up in the house.
You were telling us though between parts that the one time that you have gone to try and put two bottles away,
the machine didn't work. So I was going across to the shop and I said, we keep the plastic bottles now beside where the bags for life are, so that like automatically you just pop the plastic bottles into your bag for life and you go off and you get your bits or whatever. And the one time that I said, oh, here, go on, I'll bring it over, the machine didn't work. And I was like, this is typical of me.
So what did you end up doing then? Did you just bring the bottles
back home?
And they're sitting there
because there was a bin beside where it goes, that was overflowing. The bin, like, so beside the machine that didn't work, there was a bin you could put your bottles into, but actually that was overflowing. I didn't want to add. So I would have, like, actually had to put my bottles on the floor in the shop, and I was a bit too embarrassed to do that, so I just brought them home.
Yeah. One complaint that I did notice actually coming in, I'm just browsing through them again, I'm noticing it as a consistent thread, is not so much that the machines are broken, but that on a couple of instances, they go to the small, like a small Tesco or a Spar, that they're, their closest one is a convenience store rather than a full supermarket. And that because the machines are that bit smaller.
No, that's like my one. That's the one that I want.
That they fill up a little bit more quickly. So it's not that the machine is broken, but actually rather that it's much like when you go to any other bin, that the bin there is a bit full and you end up overflowing. But that seems to be a major grievance that they have. The money we get back for stuff in the house, toilet roll, washing up liquid, etc., some person says. One person says, I am anti the having to pay an extra deposit, but I am pro getting the money back afterwards. Which I guess means that that person is very happy about it. Should just say as well, by the way, we did ask last week for people to send in voice notes about the housing situation.
And I did get a couple of voice notes, by the way. And if you sent them to me, I didn't get back to you. Know that I did get them.
Yes, she did get them.
I did get them.
We will
Thank
use
you.
Them, though. Next week, but it, by all means, do keep your voice notes coming to any of the three of us at News Chambers, at Gav Riley, or at SarahKing.news on Instagram, because it is something that we do intend to come back to.
And do you know what I loved, by the way, just to credit the people who did send them, they sent them really lengthy ones, so you can only record a minute, but don't feel like, don't feel stopped by that 1 minute. Feel free to fire off two or three of them if you're on a bit of a rant, because like the few that I got, they were kind of 3 and 4 minutes long. So you're more than welcome to send us your long-winded thoughts on housing.
Yeah, and there's a lot to say. And no doubt when we do get to doing a full item on the show, there will be an awful lot to get through. So by all means, please do keep your voice notes coming. And thank you to the people who've sent them so far. Now, a little peek inside the fourth wall about how we pull together the podcast. We have come to think of part four as being Culture Corner. And Zara and I were speaking earlier on saying, you know, have you been watching or seeing anything new? Do we want to go down that machinery of having another Taylor Swift part? And we decided that we didn't, partly because what more can we add to the immense discourse that's already out there, and partly because neither of us has yet listened to it Post Department. Yeah. So maybe that's a future thing. Maybe Richard's got some thoughts on it that we might come back to next week. But I did then ask you what you were watching. And you told me that you were rewatching The Thick of It, which is great. And would happily recommend that all
the time.
Tell
people what The Thick of It is if they don't know.
Well, The Thick of It is a sort of mockumentary style political satire about the inner workings of a British government in the late noughties or early 2010s.
I will say it hasn't aged well for anyone who's a little bit horrified. Some of the comments in it are horrific.
It was, some of the comments were horrific enough at the time. Yeah. But what was more striking was I was asking you, where were you streaming it from? And you said,
I texted Richard and Gav back and was like, we're watching it on a DVD player in our house.
And I was like, granny.
Actually, no, it's a Blu-ray player.
Okay.
I actually don't even know.
But you were watching it on a DVD.
So it's a box set we're watching, an actual box set.
Which is then amazing, because it kind of brings up the question of how quickly box sets have become redundant, that they're just kind of not part of anyone's lives anymore.
No. So when we got engaged and moved in together, you know, you start to accumulate your belongings. Mm. And I was thrilled to see that he owned a DVD player, because...
Can we just retroactively, by the way, just confirm now that it is your fiancé who's the person that does the recycling?
He does, my fiancé. They just does the bins in our house. I'm all about equality, but I'm not doing the bins. But he has a DVD player, and we had a number of DVDs. And also, you have that moment where you're sort of unboxing all your belongings and realise that you both own the mammoth box set of The West Wing. So we now have two of those. Yeah. So that's fantastic. But yeah, so he had the thick of it, and I was like, oh my God, I love this. I've not seen it in years. And so yeah, we've been really enjoying that. But you were like, where are we streaming it? And I was like, we're actually watching it on DVD.
Yeah.
But you have DVDs. Do you own a DVD player?
Well, actually, I'm not sure if we even do have DVDs anymore. I think a couple of years ago, we might have sent them to a charity shop, possibly, because we are in our house almost 10 years, 10 years this autumn.
Oh.
And we've never had a DVD player in the house.
But do you have a collection of DVDs to watch?
If there are, I don't know where they are anymore.
Yeah, I'm
sure that there were ones in previous houses that we lived together, but at some point they were just either sent to a charity shop or packed away because we just haven't had them. Which is actually fascinating because I became aware about a month ago that my kids have never known a time where they couldn't just have whatever content they wanted on demand all the time. And the penny only dropped when we had to go to my parents' house. We were going there for a weekend afternoon, I think a Sunday afternoon or something. And when we arrived there, the internet was momentarily down. So we went into the front room and my kids were like, right, give us Blippi or Bluey or Peppa Pig or whatever it is that they wanted at that particular time. And the smart TV wasn't able to connect to the internet for 10 minutes. And this was...
End of the world territory.
This was the sky is falling in. This is dreadful. And like, it just, it took an awful lot of like reasoning with them for them to suddenly understand that they're not living in an era where if you want Peppa Pig Festival of Fun, that like it can just be loaded.
No, they are, but the thing is, they are living in an era where they can have whatever they want.
But does it blow your mind that how different that is from time past, where you like you'd have to go out, if you wanted to see a film, you'd have to go out to a shop, go down to your local like corner shop, and rent the VHS, and then rewind it when you were done, and not just have it at the drop of a hat all the time.
But we were just talking about that at the weekend because you were saying, do you remember when you were small and you get up on a Saturday morning and you'd race down the stairs to watch cartoons or whatever was on TV?
Yeah.
But TV scheduling at that time was such that you know the cartoons were only on up until a point, maybe like 10 in the morning or 11.
Yeah.
And then the programming switched to like when the teenagers were getting out of bed. So then you had like your sat TV and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And it was more geared towards like preteens and like boy bands went on and had big appearances on those types of TV shows and probably did quite well out of them. And then after that, it was sort of like into maybe the lunchtime news and then sports for the afternoon. Exactly. Yeah. But it was like, it was such a big part of kind of how your day was modeled probably back in those days when you were a kid. But it's funny because I remember, and I think I always have said that this is probably one of the reasons how I ended up working in news actually, is that when we would go to Cork to stay with Nana and Grandad, myself and my cousins would be with them for a few days over the summer. There'd be cartoons in the morning, but then once Nana was up, she'd be like, Sky News, Rolling News would be on like all day. Forget the cartoons. Go outside and play. Or if you want to be inside in front of the TV, then you've got to watch the news.
So that was your like your first exposure to schedules that weren't just like kids' TV in the morning before school hours.
Yeah, she loved Rolling News and Grandad still to this day would buy every newspaper cover. So we were kind of just constantly exposed to sort of news and current affairs, and it just like it was it was either cartoons for up until a point and then it was news or else go outside and play.
I saw actually a really interesting tweet on this line last week from someone someone British based who said that they'd been at their own parents' house for a weekend and their parents don't have any satellite or cable TV package. Can recommend a good cable TV provider. if anyone wants to know who exactly is, see that logo there? Really good. But they were at their parents' house and they had no other TV subscriptions or anything. So they only had whatever the free-to-air channels were. And they found themselves just channel hopping and ended up, for want of anything else to watch, watching a documentary that was on BBC Two or something, which they otherwise would never, ever have watched. And they were saying that it wasn't so much that they stopped and watched something unplanned that they were thinking about it, but rather the points that were raised in the documentary were still like living with them and they were still germinating over them in their heads a week later. And they thought that that was actually amazing and it only made them realise what you're missing by living in a time where you can have whatever content you want at the drop of a hat and not kind of being at the mercies of the TV scheduling gods who will decide what it is that you're watching and when.
Yeah, it is true. And I think as well, you know, when we look at how much choice we have nowadays, sometimes I feel totally paralysed by that choice when I go in and I sit down at home and I go, oh, what do we watch this evening? And then you're scrolling and flicking. That I actually do sometimes find myself just abandoning that and going back to the regular sort of four or five channels that are on the first run on the box and going, right, what's actually on live TV right now?
And or watching the same comfort films.
Or watching the same film over and over again. Do you find that?
Yeah, sometimes. I think there's times where I've ended up going back to watch probably the American remake of The Office, because when you're going through Netflix or Prime Video or whatever it is, that you just find yourself in that paralysis where there's actually too much option. I'm sure there's a name for that scientific phenomenon. If there is.
It's a paradox of choice or something.
Yeah,
is it?
But that people that you're just looking there and you're like that dreadful ad for that other TV provider
who we won't
name nor gratify. But the thing with the guy is basically freeze framing because he can't pick out what it is to say.
Yeah.
And I am amazed that it took me so long to realise that is not the era that kids these days are growing up in, but that I was just
I'll give you one more example of that, right? Is you remember when Friends was on at the time and we were all, you know, teenagers and watching Friends and like you'd have the cliffhanger of a season end and like wondering
the big TV moment when Ross was getting married to Emily.
Oh my God, yes. So we were rewatching Friends recently and like that, the cliffhanger happens and then we just press play on the next episode because the entire box set's there obviously and everything is available. But I actually love now when like, you know, streaming services will drop things week after week and they drip feed
stuff. Like Baby Reindeer at the moment, where 100%. They're only doing one episode at a time.
I think it's brilliant. I think, you know, some don't get me wrong, we all love to binge a box set, but actually I love the sort of anticipation of what will happen next week and the wondering, like Succession when it was on at the time and we all discussed it week after week. I actually think that the way that we operate and engage with programmes when we're sort of having to wait for it, nothing worthwhile ever comes easy almost. It's that sort of cliche that getting to live for the next episode week after week, I think, is actually far more enjoyable.
What will be the next actual box set then, if you're still looking at the DVDs actually, and hard copy?
I actually think we probably should watch the West Wing scenes. We have two.
You can afford to wear them out.
I think I could probably like quote a lot of it word for word, though, which is very lame.
Probably could.
Yeah.
Let us know your comfort box set, if there are still box sets in your household. Again, all of our socials, News Chambers, Gav Riley, or at ZaraKing.news. The group chat at virginmedia.ie is where, if you want to do really old fashioned email, that's where you get us. Until then, thank you, Zara.
Thanks.
Thank you, Gareth and Adam, and everyone else in the gallery, Dan and Sinead on the floor. And we will talk to you again next week.
Bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.